I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A new climate report from the U.S. government points to huge impacts across the country, some still to come, some already in progress. Last Friday, Black Friday, the White House released the National Climate Assessment, a major report mandated by Congress and compiled by 13 federal agencies. The report comes on the heels of the dire report from the International Panel on Climate Change, which predicted dire consequences of climate change much earlier than previously expected. This new report details the impact on the U.S. economy an increasing global temperature could have, and it also points out that before the next two decades are up, the Northeast is projected to be more than 3.6 degrees warmer than pre-industrial times. The Northeast, our region, will have the largest increase in temperature in the lower 48, and it's going to happen earlier than the average for the rest of the globe. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to localize what we're seeing in that report. And we're going to talk about the effects of climate change on our region in some specific areas, weather and wildlife. We'll look at changes we're already seeing and what we might expect. Joining us first is Jason Schaefer. He's a professor of atmospheric sciences and director of the Vermont Institute of Applied Meteorology at Northern Vermont University. He's also president and CEO of Northview Weather, which works with utilities to help them prepare for snow, ice, and windstorms. Jason, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Hi, Jane. It's great to be here.
In the big picture, so before we get into some of the nitty-gritty on weather, in the big picture, what does it mean that the Northeast will have the largest forecast temperature increase in the lower 48?
It means that our temperatures are warming at a pretty rapid rate, and that rate is not distributed over the seasons equally. In particular, it's warming faster in the wintertime. So a lot of our climate signals we're seeing, our signals are strongest in the wintertime.
Why is the Northeast warming faster than the rest of the country?
Well, a lot of it comes down to water and temperatures, how they're affected by water in the atmosphere. The climate is generally getting wetter and warmer, and as it gets wetter, it positively feeds back to it. So the nighttime temperatures in the middle of wintertime are actually warming the fastest of all the temperatures we look at because there's more moisture in the atmosphere, and that acts as a good greenhouse gas. So not as much of the heat goes back out to space when you have more moisture in it. And in the summertime, the same thing is true. The nighttime low temperatures are just a little bit warmer as well.
All right. So let's talk about some of the things that people can see and feel and experience and things that are happening now and what might happen in the future. Now, we just had this big wet snowstorm last week, and I know you suggested we could actually use that as a jumping off point. How so?
Yeah. So our climate, we're in a unique place for the wintertime. We go above and below 32 degrees pretty often, and we get lots of precipitation and a pretty active pattern of the jet stream. So we're going to have, and we see it now currently, we're going to have more opportunities to have more precipitation during the wintertime when it's around 32 degrees. And the problem is usually when you're right around 32 degrees because the snow tends to be wet and sticky and cause more problems. And then you could have more cold air at the surface and warm air on top of that, and you can get things like Mother Nature's F-word, freezing rain, and ice storms. So the storms are going to get wetter, and in the wintertime, we're seeing more snowfall, in fact, in parts of northern Vermont, until the climate's too warm for that to happen.
Explain how that works, how, you know, we're seeing a temperature rise. We're already seeing a global temperature rise, and certainly one here that correlates to that. But in the next few years, you know, as you said, we may be seeing more snow, not just more precipitation, but more snow until we get sort of tip over that warming point.
That's right. Yeah. So in some of the deeper valleys in southern Vermont are already seeing less snowfall. And you got to keep in mind that just one or two big storms can make a lot of the annual snowfall for some of the valleys in the southern Vermont. So you have to look at extreme weather events and climate. It's hard to pull those out separately. But we're just basically in northern Vermont, especially in the mountains, we're still cold enough that that extra precipitation still falls as snow before it gets too warm and falls more as rain.
Hmm. So these snowstorms like last week's that are right around 32, and that's a specific kind of snow that often dumps during those snowstorms. You were pointing that out, that it's wetter, it's heavier because it's not cold enough to have that light, fluffy snow that we liked, you know, in the 10 to 25 range.
Yeah, that's correct. Wet snow, it just sticks to everything, and then when it sticks on power lines and trees, that's no good because it can cause all sorts of failures. And it's not uncommon to have wet snow, especially early in the season. In the fall, we're still kind of early in the wintertime, and also in the tail ends of the season. But I suspect that we're going to see more storms like this. And the other thing that was really unique about this storm was the fact that the temperatures pretty much stayed 30 degrees for 5 days after, and the winds went light. So the snow stayed weighted onto everything, so it caused a lot more problems. We had a storm like this December 2014. And that type of behavior of storms actually becoming stronger and slowing down is something that's consistent with climate changing as well.
Why? What happens that, and we saw this in the summertime a while back, a couple years ago as well, where it felt like something was just sticking around for like a week or 2 weeks without the weather changing significantly. Why is that a feature of climate change?
Yeah, so there's a few things happening there. The two primary energy sources for weather systems and storms come from temperature gradients and how much moisture they have available. And what we're seeing is that there's generally more moisture that's available for some of these storms, and they can intensify faster. And one of the effects of a storm getting stronger faster is it has a higher likelihood of cutting itself off from the circulation of the atmosphere just because it intensifies so rapidly. And the other thing, as the temperatures are warming, the jet stream is shifting a little bit further north. So the westerly winds that tend to blow stuff through are just not here as often and frequent to clean the atmosphere out. So those two things are acting together to get stuck into those type of patterns. And that's part of the amplification of the water cycle as well. We're getting into more wet periods and then also really strong dry periods. We had drought this summer in northern Vermont, whereas southern Vermont had actually above average wetness.
So that's one of the features of climate change as well, is that you see this very, very different situations in different parts of the country. And in this instance, I mean, within a micro region, you know, it's sort of southern Vermont versus northern Vermont, really different kinds of climates for the or weather related patterns for the summertime.
Yes, in this case, in this year it was. And I would say in general that the seasons are just less reliable and more anomalous, in that you're seeing different types of weather you might not expect at different times of the year. And I would come back to the comment about winter and snow getting higher, but the other thing we're also seeing in the wintertime is we're seeing a lot more thaws, a lot more rain on snow. So even though you're getting more snow, doesn't mean the quality of that snow is good.
Are you speaking like a recreator now, the quality of snow, or is that an actual meteorological thought?
I guess two hats there. But a lot of us live here because we like the winter season, right? And we don't like it when it's snow and ice and rains in the middle of winter.
We're talking right now about weather and weather patterns and climate change. We're jumping off this new report that looks at the U.S. climate and how it's changing and points out specifically that the Northeast is warming more rapidly than other parts of the country. And we're trying to address today a little bit of what that looks like, what that means, what we're already seeing and what we might be seeing in the next two decades or so as we see our average temperature rise as much as 3.6 degrees by 2035. Listeners, if you have a question, if you'd like to share your own observations, right now we're talking weather. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about mammals, and then we're going to talk about birds and insects as well. We'd love to know what you're thinking, what you're seeing, and what questions you have about this. Our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Jason, we got an email from Steve that talks a little bit about plants, but also atmosphere. And so you might be able to help us tackle this one. Steve says, I agree the weather patterns seem to have changed since the 1960s. However, as CO2 levels increase, will plants grow faster, absorbing more CO2? It seems that the last few years, both herbaceous and woody plants are growing like crazy. Also, as the atmosphere warms, will more water evaporate and actually cause cooling? The atmosphere is very complex, and just taking a small picture and extrapolating the future is unwise. We can make predictions, but no one knows exactly what will happen. So two things to tackle there, Jason Schaefer. One are Steve's questions about CO2 levels and plants growing and absorbing more CO2. And then as the atmosphere warms, will more water evaporate and actually cause cooling? Can you tackle those first? And then we'll talk about how modeling and predictions work.
Sure. The evaporation question first. If you get more evaporation of water into the atmosphere, that won't have a cooling effect. In fact, that evaporation process that happens from plants will tend to put more water vapor into the atmosphere. And water vapor is such a powerful greenhouse gas. In fact, it's the most important one, the most abundant one of all. We often don't talk about it because CO2 is what we can control, what we're contributing to that. That effect will actually have a modifying effect. And it's true that the carbon uptake of plants, well, if there is more carbon in the atmosphere for them to use, they're going to take up more of it. So, and that's somewhat species dependent, as I understand, and how fast they'll grow. But the growing season is also getting longer as part of this, too, because the frost-free period is just larger with the warmer periods. So that's also contributing to more rapid plant growth. So there's maybe an upside to agriculture across the state.
So an upside to agriculture, but just to be clear on the question of can more plant growth actually help mitigate the effects of climate change, it doesn't sound like it.
That it does, and that the plants will take up more carbon a little faster, but that's not a large enough portion of the pie for us to just rely on and hope that that's going to solve our problems.
Okay, and more water evaporation won't actually cause cooling.
No, there is evaporation as it does release from the plant, but the amount of water that's in the air, that's being produced in the air, that is a greenhouse gas is just really effective and will tend to trap more heat before it goes back out to space.
Hmm. So Steve also said, you know, the atmosphere is complex. Taking a small picture and extrapolating the future is unwise, and we have these predictions, but no one knows what will happen. How do you respond to that?
I think that we have a pretty informed scientific consensus on what's happening with our climate system, and weather can be hard to forecast, but the directions of where climate is going and our contributions to it are pretty clear in that we're putting a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's this very strong greenhouse gas. It's just the laws of physics are the laws of physics. We can't get around that, and there's a lot that we need to do to try to mitigate, and then if we can't mitigate, to try to adapt to climate change.
So you mentioned, Jason, a little bit of what we might see in the summertime. So we talked a little bit about winter in the short range, more snow perhaps, but less stability, less of a sense of, okay, this is the norm, this is what's likely to happen. And in the summertime, as you said, in northern Vermont, we had a drought. In southern Vermont, we had more water. What else might we see during these seasons that, while unpredictable, is predicted?
Yeah, the summertime is, the signals aren't as strong there. Things like summertime thunderstorms, we don't necessarily know a whole lot about in terms of how that's going to change things. The nighttime temperatures throughout the year will continue to get warmer. And there's other impacts on insects and health, human health potentially. If you get more heat waves, heat actually in terms of global health impacts causes more deaths than anything else. And we don't tend to get a lot of heat waves here, but those will probably become a little more likely in the next 5, 10, 20 years across Vermont.
So what should we be on the lookout for in terms of how we might need to respond? It sounds like with more unpredictable extreme weather, we're going to have to be looking at how all of our systems respond to that, utilities, warning systems, how our houses and all of our landscape is ready for that kind of extreme weather. What else?
Yeah, I think we just have to have a mindset of resilience and a willingness that we're all going to have to pay for this one way or another. And, you know, how what that means for individual decisions, it really depends on everyone's situation. But when the nature strikes and the storms are powerful, we just have to be ready to be hardened and ready to respond to that.
Is that one of the reasons why you started Northview Weather? And as I said, this works with utilities to help them prepare for weather-related issues. It seems like a good time to be in that business.
Yeah. Well, what I saw in a lot of industry practices was a mismatch between the level of what we know about weather forecasting and what we can do with that. So oftentimes organizations, I saw the science being sitting on the shelf, and I wanted to take the best weather research and science and stuff we're doing to help utilities prepare for storms so they could get the power back on for all of us faster, essentially.
That's Jason Schaefer, a professor of atmospheric sciences and director of the Vermont Institute of Applied Meteorology at Northern Vermont University. He's also president and CEO of Northview Weather. Jason, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Jane.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're jumping off the National Climate Assessment, a report released last week that shows the Northeast warming faster than other parts of the country. We're looking at signs already present here and what we might expect in the next 20 years. We already talked about weather, and now we're going to look at animals, large animals first, and fish, then birds and bugs. Tom Rogers is a biologist for the Fish and Wildlife Department in Vermont. He's actually giving a presentation on December 13th in Waterbury about the impact of climate change on Vermont wildlife. And he joins us now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here.
Can you talk a little bit about what biologists are already observing when it comes to climate change and Vermont's animals?
Sure. So one of the flagship species for climate change in Vermont is our moose population. People hear a lot about winter ticks, and winter ticks are a different species than the black-legged ticks that we all know from Lyme disease. Winter ticks are primarily affecting moose in Vermont, and they've become much more prolific as springs become less snowier and falls become milder. And so right now we're in the middle of a three-year-long study where we've radio-collared moose, and we're trying to figure out, you know, what the trends are, what's killing moose in the state of Vermont, and what we can do to try to help them.
Yeah, we've heard a lot about moose just being completely overcome by these winter ticks and how bad it can be for them. What about other species? I'm thinking of bears, for example. We know that bears sometimes come out of hibernation when we have thaws or when the weather is warm. Are we seeing changes in bear behavior?
That's right. Our bear biologist is observing more reports of bears being out and about in the wintertime. Bears, unlike a lot of species, don't actually go into true hibernation. They're mostly just in what's called winter dormancy for the winter, meaning that they're mostly just sleeping. And so they're easily aroused. And so a nice, cold, snowy winter where the snowpack will seal up their den and kind of keep them sheltered and protected from the cold temperatures and the winds, they'll sleep throughout the entire winter. Whereas if you get, as Jason mentioned, a lot of these winter rain events or really unpredictable winter weather, that can be hard for bears. And they can actually get flooded out of their dens and be out and about in the wintertime, where previously we wouldn't see that nearly as much.
Are you seeing other animals react to those unpredictable changes and more thaws?
Yeah, you know, unpredictability is exactly the right word. So that's really difficult for wildlife to adapt to. Previously, wildlife had, you know, centuries or millennia to adapt to changes in climate. And now it's happening so quickly that we're not sure that all the species are going to be able to keep up with it. So, for instance, when birds are migrating, when the insects are popping out as a result of the buds coming out, all of that is changing really fast. And it can sometimes be difficult for wildlife to adapt to that. So, for example, this year we saw bluebirds nesting and wood ducks present at Dead Creek on February 24th. So, you know, that's kind of early for some of those behaviors. The other big thing is that a lot of the invasive species in Vermont are much more flexible and adaptable to this unpredictability. And so they can change very rapidly as a result of climate change, whereas a lot of our native species might not be able to. So, for example, we're seeing that purple loosestrife, an invasive plant, is blooming earlier in the year as a result of warmer springs, whereas our native cattails are not keeping up. They're not blooming quite as early.
Let's go to Demir, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Demir. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jay. How are you?
Well, thank you. What are you thinking, questioning?
Okay, thank you for taking me in the program. General thinking, as we know that, for example, ticks got here in the end of 80s together with the opossums that, as we know, they eat them. So I was wondering, you know, can we expect also those different species such as venomous snakes to migrate as well in next 20 years, can we start seeing them around here and, some other animals too?
Yeah, Demir, thank you for the question. That's really interesting. You know, Tom Rogers, as we see the Northeast warm, are we going to be seeing new species coming into this region because it's either more like what they've experienced previously in southern regions or they're just more able to be here when they weren't in the past?
That's a great question. And in regards to venomous snakes, Jane, as you well know, we actually have a population of venomous snakes. We have native timber rattlesnakes right here in Vermont already.
That's right. A very small population, just for people who this is the first time they've heard that.
Exactly. A small population on conserved lands in Rutland County, so not generally a concern for most people. But absolutely, we are seeing some new species in the state, and we probably expect to continue to see new species, not just species that are easily able to move, such as animals, but even some plants that are probably going to be migrating northward across the landscape in a changing climate. So black vultures, we're starting to see. Coyotes are a newer species over the last half century to Vermont, and that's just as much a result of, you know, land use changes and other things as climate change. But we do absolutely expect to see more species in Vermont. And there's a lot of discussion as to what we can do or what we should be doing to help facilitate that, or if we even should be helping to facilitate that. So some people talk about, you know, a rare plant that exists only on mountaintops in the Smoky Mountains. As climate changes, what is the ethical decision as to whether or not we should be moving that, say, to the top of Mount Mansfield, where the conditions are going to be more like what it was used to? And there's really no single consensus on how scientists should be responding to that.
What do you think?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. It's a matter of, you know, it's not just the climate that necessarily something is adapted to. There are all kinds of biotic and abiotic factors. And so there are a lot of ins and outs of moving species from one area to another. There's no right or wrong answer. And I think you have to take it on a case-by-case basis per species.
What about species moving out of our region? You know, when we think about, say, the moose, and moose are not doing well here, are they likely to do better in northern Canada? Or are we going to see the demise of some species, even ones that are here in Vermont?
Yeah, moose is a great example because moose are doing much better farther north. They are doing much better farther north, yeah. Not only are they not plagued by the winter ticks generally because the tick populations are not nearly as high or even existent as you get farther north because of the colder, snowier winters and springs, but moose are a very cold adapted animal. They actually will get heat stress in the high 50 degrees, about 57 degrees Fahrenheit will start to stress a moose out because it's too hot for them to even cool down. And so as summers consistently get warmer, that's the time of year that it's really crucial for moose to be bulking up and eating a lot in order to get through the winter. And if instead of eating, they're just laying around in a cool spot trying to cool off or wading in streams trying to just get their body temperature down, that can be detrimental. So maybe in the next couple centuries, pretty much no matter what we do, we may see a moose move northward out of the state.
Let's go to Sharon, who's calling in from Berkshire. Hi, Sharon. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is about some of the climate modeling shows that Vermont may become a much drier state, and our forests have been reliant on a rot or mold model for regeneration and breaking materials down and not a fire model. What's the likelihood that we're going to start having to deal with forest fires?
Thanks for the call. Tom Rogers, do you have a sense of that?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I don't know I haven't heard drier per se. Jason would probably be able to speak to this more, but it sounds from his discussion like things are generally getting wetter here in the Northeast, that wet places in the country are getting wetter and drier places are getting drier. We do actually use controlled burns a little bit in April as a habitat management technique. And it's generally pretty hard to start those fires. They have to stand around with little instruments waiting for the exact right humidity and wind and all of these things in order to actually even get the fires to go, even under perfect conditions. I don't see necessarily forest fires being an issue for us in the very near future, just because Vermont in the Northeast is generally such a wet, humid climate.
Tom, you've talked about some of the issues that we're seeing. A lot of invasive species that are able to adapt more quickly, gaining more of a foothold here, while in some of our native species that can't adapt to the changing climate and changing agriculture as quickly, having a problem, increased forest pests, increased ticks, maybe increased mosquitoes we're hearing as well. Mm-hmm. What can we do?
There are a lot of things we can do. This is a great thing. So everything we do in the Fish and Wildlife Department and with our partners as well, we have climate change in mind in those management actions. So the single greatest thing we can do really is maintaining healthy and connected habitats. Climate change is going to accelerate a lot of those threats that you talked about, invasive species, habitat fragmentation, habitat loss. And so we are really working hard to make sure that Vermont has healthy and connected habitats so that as wildlife need to adapt to all this unpredictability and all these changing climates, that they can find the resources they need in the different seasons. They can move from one place to the next.
Tom Rogers is a biologist for the Fish and Wildlife Department, and if you want to know more, he's giving a presentation on December 13th in Waterbury that actually talks about the impact of climate change on Vermont wildlife. Tom, thanks for telling us a little bit about what you know.
Thanks very much.
Listeners, if you have observations to share, you can post them on the VPR Facebook page, or you can call us 1-800-639-2211. Judith emailed in to say one of the primary things we are seeing out on the dirt roads as our climate changes is multiple mud seasons. It used to be we could count on a solid mud season in maybe late March through mid-April. We now get 10 or more mud seasons throughout the winter. This wreaks havoc on the roads, the cars, and the town highway budgets. Again, share your perspective. You can post it on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Kent McFarland is a conservation biologist at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, and he's host, as you know, of VPR's Outdoor Radio. He was also part of the 2007 Northeast Climate Impacts Assessment Team led by the Union of Concerned Scientists. And he's here now to talk about birds and bugs and how climate change is affecting and will affect them. Kent, it's nice to talk with you.
Thanks for having me on, Jane.
So how is climate change already affecting birds in Vermont?
Well, with birds, there's winners and losers, and we already have some winners. The winners tend to be birds that are already common in most places, and the losers tend to be, in the future, those that are more specialized. So some of the losers we're going to have in the future are probably going to be things like our iconic common loon. It's a northern species, loves northern lakes. It's probably going to shift northward.
But it's been doing so well lately.
It has been doing really well. That's what's disturbing. We spent a lot of time in bringing the loon back and doing a great job. And that's one of the iconic species that might decline. Another iconic species is our mountaintop species, things like Bicknell's thrush, which are up in the montane fir forests. We predict with just 2 degrees Celsius increase in mean July temperature that bird is going to retreat away from Vermont, definitely away from the Catskills of New York, and probably only found in places like the White Mountains. So those are some of our iconic losers. Recently, some of the common birds that we see right in our feeders right now, our bird feeders right now, are those that we think are winners already. Things like northern cardinal and tufted titmouse. Those two species actually were not in Vermont prior to the 1960s and have been steadily moving northward in the 70s, 80s, and through the 90s until now. Tufted titmouse is a really common species here. Mm-hmm. It was actually first found breeding in Vermont, I think, in like 1978. Wow. And now in a lot of our places, we find tufted titmouse is breeding. We find them at our bird feeders. It's complex of what's caused that northward movement. It probably has something to do with habitat change and more bird feeders, believe it or not. But climate change factors big in how some of these birds are moving northward.
Kent, when you say winners and losers, are we talking about just in Vermont, you know, things that we're going to see and not see? Or are we actually looking at bird species in our region or ones that we're familiar with that might actually struggle to survive?
We're talking about in our region that might struggle to survive. So, I mean, I brought up Bicknell's thrush as an example. That's one that just has nowhere to go. It lives on mountaintops. It can only go up in elevation so far before it runs out of space. So that would be one that could be just completely lost if there's too much warming.
One of the things that you mentioned in how we could talk about birds that I didn't realize is that climate change is actually affecting the physical size of some birds.
Yeah, I mean, this really blew me away when I found out about it. But red-bellied woodpeckers is another bird that recently came into Vermont. It first showed up in the 1970s in Vermont, and now red-bellied woodpeckers can be found through both the big valleys. It can be found in the Connecticut River Valley, in the Champlain Valley, and now it's even climbing up a little bit in elevation. It bred in my backyard last year for the first time ever, and I've been living in that place for 25 years. That species has been moving for about the last 50 years steadily northward. It's found the whole way up into Canada now. And believe it or not, there's this rule in ecology called Bergman's rule, which the rule is that the colder climate you have, so the further north or higher in elevation, the bigger your populations tend to be in size. So red-bellied woodpeckers at the northern end of their range tend to be the biggest individuals. And it makes sense kind of because bigger individuals lose heat less quickly. They have less surface-to-volume ratio. And it was found out recently, going back and looking at red-bellied woodpeckers, that red-bellied woodpeckers that are now at our latitude are now – Not the giant red-bellied woodpeckers that we used to find here in the 1980s when they first arrived, but they're actually the smaller size red-bellied woodpeckers. So in other words, Bergman rule is working, and that as we've warmed up, the red-bellied woodpeckers we have here in Vermont are actually kind of getting smaller.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it blows me away.
I know we're talking about birds here, but also bugs and other flying things. Bugs are in particular really affected by climate change. Big Boston Globe article recently about how we're facing some really terrible consequences for insects in America and elsewhere because of climate change. What about butterflies here in our region?
Well, butterflies are a great indicator of changes, and we're already seeing here in Vermont changes that are happening. And one of them that I like to point out is this butterfly that just showed up in 2010 called the Eastern Giant Swallowtail, which is the biggest swallowtail in North America. The thing looks like a bat when it flies. It's huge. And it showed up in Vermont in 2010. A gardener noticed it in her backyard and reported it to us. And within weeks, everyone was reporting these giant swallowtails in Vermont. Now, it's a southern species. It's usually much further south of here. But for the last, decade or so, it's been steadily marching northward. And now we have that every year. We have that species here. It's a breeding species in Vermont. It's here to stay, it looks like. It's control. It overwinters in its chrysalis. So at the end of fall, it spins its chrysalis and hangs out all winter long until spring when the adult breaks out of the chrysalis and flies around. And it's thought that winter temperatures control how far north this species can go. And it looks like we've warmed up enough that every year now since 2010, it has bred in Vermont and done really well.
Huh. I'm thinking as we talk about this, you know, things like speaking of butterflies, we saw a big invasion or, you know, a big arrival of painted ladies a year or two ago into the late summer. And it was this big explosion of these special butterflies. And we talk about it in birds as well. You know, you'll have a lot of birds of a certain kind, or you'll see snowy owls coming down. Now, some of that may be related to a changing climate and some of it's not. And it's hard to tell as a layperson what is related to a changing climate and what is just a rare occurrence. I mean, for example, I've been reading about a really rare South American hawk that seems to have taken up residence in Portland, Maine this winter.
Right.
Now, that could be just this one hawk either has a screw loose in its head or, you know, something blown off course or decided to come sightseeing for the winter. Or we could say that's a sign of climate change. How do we know?
Yeah, well, we just like the weather guys and the climate people look for signals and over long periods of time to say that climate is changing, we sort of do the same thing in ecology. We look for signals that keep repeating themselves over time. So, you know, one black hawk in Maine might not be a real signal, but suddenly if another one shows up in New York and then 2 years later another one shows up and all of a sudden you have them all over the place, that would be a signal that we start thinking to ourselves, huh, something is going on here. The climate has changed. The pattern of the bird has changed. Something has made this happen. So, you know, a one-off of something happening is kind of like, well, that was interesting. That was fun to look at. But when it starts repeating itself with more periodicity, then we start thinking like, okay, there's a pattern here and we ought to link that to something. And often it's related to climate change, unfortunately. It doesn't mean it's not also related to something like changes in habitat or changes in land use patterns, but often we find that a factor involved is climate change.
Let's go to Carla, who's calling in from Fairfax. Hi, Carla. You have a question?
Hi. Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
I had a question about the moose. So I don't know if our biologist on bugs and birds can answer it.
Yeah, Carla, take it away. Give us your question about moose.
We'll give it a shot.
Well, back in the 1990s was when moose first appeared in Vermont. I know when I was growing up as a little girl, I never heard of any moose in Vermont. And now we have signs, moose crossing and all that. Well, then a little bit later in your program, the other biologist said as the winter gets colder, the weather gets colder, the moose will move north. Well, I want to know why the moose came down in the first place.
Carla, yeah, let me give this to Kent. So first of all, it's as the winters get warmer, the moose will move north. So we're going to see more snow, but overall the temperature is rising, so the winters are going to get warmer. But Carla's saying, you know, she didn't see moose in her childhood. Now she sees moose. What is happening? Kent, we talk about this again with birds as well, but to Carla's question about moose, you know, what's going on here?
Yeah, well, I'm an ornithologist going rogue and be a mammalogist now. But basically, I think it's mostly had to do with land use change prior to that. And even going back further, unregulated hunting probably. So the first time when we lost moose, it was probably had to do with massive changes in land use with becoming an agrarian landscape instead of a wooded landscape, and probably over hunting going way back. And so that changed. We went back to a forested landscape. Moose came back from great management. And maybe they came back too strong. There might have been too many moose recently, setting the stage for things like winter ticks to take their toll on disease. So I think prior to that, it was a land use thing, and now it's a climate change thing.
Hmm. Ken, just 20 seconds here, but I want to give you a chance to tell people how we can help or what we can do with our observations on birds and bugs and all animals as we look to what's changing.
Well, all the stuff I've talked about has come from citizen scientists helping biologists record where species are and when. And so we have a big project called the Vermont Atlas of Life. And you can dial in on that and use your smartphone to dial into iNaturalist or Vermont eBird or even this project called eButterfly. Anyone can join these sort of crowdsourced projects and help us sort of massively find out where species are and when they are there to help us sort of find signals out there that are going on with climate change. And maybe we can do something about some of these through management and conservation.
And we'll put links up at vpr.net. You can click on today's Vermont Edition page. Kent McFarland is a conservation biologist at the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, and he's host of VPR's Outdoor Radio. Kent, thanks.
Thanks so much, Jane.